Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Russell Petty. I'm representing Mr. John Opetta. With me on this case is Ms. Lisa Cantor. And with the Court's permission, I'm going to strive mightily to maintain 5 minutes for rebuttal. In a nutshell, Your Honor, this case is about Mr. Opetta, who was a employee for Northwest Airlines Corporation, had an industrial injury, caused him to file a claim for a disability pension. The claim was denied. The plan had an express arbitration provision, which mandated that in the event of a dispute over permanent total disability, the matter would be submitted to
I have a difficulty with your premise. Maybe you could straighten it out. Your brief indicates this is an arbitration. Now, the nature of an arbitration is an arbitrator is selected, both sides provide evidence, the arbitrator makes a decision. Here that wasn't the case. Your client went to Dr. Gold. Dr. Gold made a decision. And all the trappings of arbitration assume that this is an arbitration case. But it doesn't look like an arbitration case. It doesn't smell like an arbitration case. It looks more like a person was designated to make a final opinion, but that isn't necessarily arbitration. How does the arbitration argument get into the case other than by counsel saying it's arbitration?
Well, you know, Your Honor, the reason why the arbitration argument gets into the case is because there was a contract in place that said that in the event of a dispute about this issue, that the parties would submit it to somebody who is a mutually agreeable arbitrator, and that person would...
Didn't use the term arbitrator. It did not use the term arbitrator. Your contract says it will be submitted to a doctor, an independent doctor, for a final decision which would bind both parties. Arbitrator was never used.
The word arbitrator was never used, Your Honor. There are numerous cases in this circuit and elsewhere that say that the language such as final and binding, which is the language that we have here, a final and binding determination, it means.
I found that in one case, it was a district court case by a very eminent district court judge. Where is a Ninth Circuit case that says when you just submit an issue to a decider that language means there's completely it's arbitration and all the trappings continue on of arbitration.
I'll cite the case, the court, for example, the McDonnell Douglas case, which is granted a Second Circuit case, but the language is it is in our estimation irrelevant that the contract language in question does not employ the word arbitration as such. Rather, what is important is that the parties clearly intended to submit some disputes to their chosen instrument for the definitive statement of certain grievances under the agreement.
What was the citation in that case?
That's 858 Fed 2nd 825.
Okay.
Well, why does it matter?
I was going to ask the same question. Don't you get to the same place, regardless whether this is an arbitration or not, when the plain language of the contract says something isn't the other party in breach of it by not abiding by it?
Your Honor, I actually really think upon reading the briefs that I agree with that completely. There's a binding agreement between the parties that the matter would be submitted to Dr. Gold and that his decision would be final with respect to this, and that both parties would be bound by that agreement. And so, you know, with respect to the trappings of arbitration, granted it doesn't look much like an arbitration case,
but
the fact of the matter is...
Why don't we stop talking about arbitration and get to the heart of
it? Let's get to Dr. Gold. So the agreement said, as Judge Wallace pointed out, it didn't say it'll go to arbitration. The agreement actually said a doctor acceptable to you and the employer will make a determination. This mm-hmm. determination will be final and binding on you and on the employer. So here we are, and that's what the language says. How does that now play into the additional evidence issue?
All right, the first issue, of course, is the as I see it, Your Honors, there are really three issues here. One of them is whether there was a waiver of the arbitration provision or of the contractual provision that this would be submitted to Dr. Gold by Mr. Repetta's conduct at trial. The second issue is whether that language is, the decision that Dr. Gold issued is clear and unambiguous or at least capable of being interpreted by the district court. And the third issue is whether presuming that Dr. Gold's decision was so unclear that it was incapable of being interpreted, whether what the district court did in response to that was appropriate. And if the court has no questions with respect to that, I'll take those in order, unless there's one issue or other that the...
All right. I think you have to separate out, too, in your discussion, which extrinsic evidence you're talking about. And it may have been that Dr. Gold's testimony might have been necessary, but that the videotapes weren't, or vice versa. I mean, in your argument, you tend to... And the argument on waiver goes to everything. I mean, simply because you might have reluctantly gone along with Judge Ray's decision to have bring Dr. Gold in to testify does not mean necessarily that there was a waiver of the... any other extrinsic evidence that was not in the administrative record.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor, and I think you're right. I think that the record is clear that the parties objected strenuously to both Dr. Gold and the videotape, but it's less clear with respect to Dr. Gold than it is, I mean, to the extent that's possible, than it is with respect to the videotape, which,
so
you know.
So let's take them one by one. Let's just first talk about Dr. Gold. And perhaps you can tell us what your what you think is reflected in the record on waiver as to having additional testimony from him, and whether there's anything about that that's at odds with Ninth Circuit case law that permits, explanation of the doctor's testimony by himself.
Well, first off, with respect to the waiver issue, I mean, I think there's at least five separate points in the record at which Mr. Repetta's counsel explicitly objected to the testimony of Dr. Gold. There was a trial brief. There was the Mr. Cantor's statements at opening. There was written objections that were filed after the opening, prior to any witness's testimony that objected to both Dr. Gold and the videotape. There was my statements at the trial opening that occurred before there was any testimony, and then after Dr. Gold testified and the videotape was shown, there was a motion to strike.
Excuse me. In relationship to Dr. Gold, at one point there was a question of whether Dr. Gold should even come, and the plaintiff attorney said, "It's fine, we'll bring him."
Your Honor, I think that misconstrues Mr. Cantor's statements. I mean, he said that, but in context, he was, he started off by telling Judge Ray that he believed all Judge Ray should do was just simply enforce the agreement that Dr. Gold's decision would be binding.
Well, he started off by saying we don't need anyone with the possible exception of Dr. Gold. Then later on, he told the judge, if you want Dr. Gold, we can bring him in. How is that not a waiver of any objection to Dr. Gold testifying?
Well,
on some basis, not indicating what he should have said, but on some basis.
Two points, Your Honor. Read in context, Mr. Cantor's statements were just a response to the defendant's position, which is that we were trying to cover up some fraud and that if more evidence could be shown. And so you had to say that we're not concerned about this evidence and there's nothing in here that would hurt us. But more significantly, the fact is that after those statements were made, the plaintiff filed written objections to Dr. Gold's testimony in the videotape. I provided this court this morning, and I'm sorry I didn't get it earlier, but I didn't discover it earlier, a letter with respect to supplemental authority. That's the General Signal Corporation case, and that stands for the proposition, it's a Ninth Circuit case, and it stands for the proposition that, a party in that case explicitly agreed to a set trial procedure. Then later on, when the set trial procedure turned out to be not so favorable for it, it then set forward objections, and this court held that the fact that you objected to something, even though you had explicitly agreed to it at some point, meant that there was no waiver, and the matter was justiciable.
Let me ask you this: if the doctor, if you didn't have the videotape, and you just had the doctor come in, then I assume you'd consider his visit to the trial kind of harmless, correct?
Certainly, Your Honor, there's what is good for our case, and then there's what's right, and what comports with the law, and those are not necessarily the same things. I think, and if you read Dr. Gold's direct, certainly all he did during his direct prior to seeing the videotape was affirm that Mr. Opetta was totally disabled.
So I'm just saying, if you could excise all the videotape, mm-hmm. Hypothetically, if you excised all of that, is there anything about his appearance at the trial that you're now saying was improper or at odds with his treating it as a binding?
Yes, Your Honor, I do, because I believe that his statement, his written decision, was clear and unambiguous, or at the very least could have certainly been enforced by the district court. It was certainly clear enough for that, and that being the case, I think that it was improper to bring in, someone who was effectively an arbitrator in order to explain to the court what he meant when there was a written decision that set forth with. I think that's improper under arbitration law. I think it's improper under ERISA law.
That doesn't, you're kind of avoiding my bottom line question is, did it matter if you excised the videotape?
The videotape is what we really have a problem with.
But do you hear my question?
Yes. Listen to the question.
If you excise the videotape testimony and testimony related to the videotape from Dr. Gold's testimony at trial, is there anything there that, in your view, could be considered anything more than harmless to your client?
There's nothing. As a matter of fact, it's entirely helpful to my client.
Let's go to the videotape. Because it all hinges on the videotape.
That's correct, Your Honor.
We're kind of starting backwards. Now let's get to the bottom of this pile, okay? What on the videotape, your argument is that really doesn't relate to the doctor's opinion, correct?
My argument is that the parties agreed to submit this to Dr. Gold. The videotape could have been submitted at the time. It was not. Dr. Gold issued an opinion, and if you're going to maintain the presence, as defendant is apparently doing, that what was really taking place before Judge Ray was just giving Dr. Gold an opportunity to clarify his opinion, which was ambiguous, it makes absolutely no sense to say, well, what we're going to do is show him additional evidence, because really what it is you're doing is you're taking a second bite at the apple. You agreed in writing that you were going to allow Dr. Gold to decide this matter. It was submitted. He decided it. And now we're having a hearing for the sole purpose, by showing him additional evidence, which is not in the record and which was not shown to him before, we're going to show him this additional evidence in an effort to get him to change his mind. And that's what took place, and I submit that it's improper, and it's in violation of the plan documents and the contract agreed to between the parties that this matter would be submitted to Dr. Gold and that Dr. Gold would decide it.
I think your argument makes a lot of sense if you read the plan document, I don't see this, obviously, arbitration, but I see it as a case to follow the contract, which has a decision maker, if that was the status. Now, I look at what Judge Ray did, and he made the decision as to whether or not your client is disabled. The question is, was he off base in making that decision? Now, I went back to the complaint, which was filed by the plaintiff in this case, and it doesn't say anything about enforcing a decision by Dr. Gold. The complaint is set up at paragraph 11. A controversy now exists between the parties to whether the plaintiff continues to be disabled as defined by the terms of the plan. Plaintiff seeks a declaration by this court that he meets the plan definition of disability and is entitled to continue long-term disability benefits from the defendant. Now, there was no pretrial order in this case, which would, by our rules, substitute the initial pleadings. So this case went to trial under the complaint. The complaint asked the district judge to make a determination as to whether your client is disabled. The district judge made the determination as to whether or not your client is disabled. Now, I wonder why we should reverse the district judge for doing. I understand your complaint. I'm just saying I'm not sure it's in the pleadings or the legal issues presented to the district judge.
Well, Your Honor, the legal issues were clearly presented to the judge. I concede the court's point that that they were not presented to the judge, you know, the precise legal issues that I'm arguing here in the context of the complaint. But there cannot be any doubt by anybody who was present or who, you know, has reviewed the record that the parties repeatedly asked the judge to limit, excuse me, Mr. Opetta's counsel repeatedly asked the judge to limit his involvement to just enforcing the plan document, which is that Dr. Gold would decide this matter. And
counsel, I mean, if the district court made a decision that it was based on evidence that never should have been admitted, then the decision would be perhaps reversible. And here, I thought you were arguing that under our law, in an ERISA case, the district court can only admit extrinsic evidence, such as videotapes, if they were necessary to the decision.
I am arguing that, Your Honor.
That's the Mongaluzzo case.
That's Mongaluzzo and Kearney, Your Honors. That and with respect to that one particular issue, you can read defendant's opposition brief at length, and they never actually respond to the issue of why is this information necessary.
Well,
if the issue
question,
is what
this question may really go to both of you, may go more to the Northwest Airlines Council, but. I guess what I'm wondering is up to the point where the videotapes were introduced, the sole evidence was that your client was totally and permanently disabled. Yet the judge made a different determination. And so isn't it only logical to assume he made it on the basis of this extrinsic evidence? And if the extrinsic evidence should not have been introduced because that was an error, then should we not reverse?
I think that's exactly an appropriate analysis.
That's the point, thrust of this case that I think you might want to reserve some time.
Yeah, you're down below your 5 minutes, so why don't we hear from Northwest Airlines?
Thanks very much, Your Honors.
May it please the Court, Your Honor, Andrew Williams on behalf of the Northwest Airline Pension Plan. There is, I think, something that needs to be cleared up in terms of counsel's presentation, which is the evidence in the record, the administrative record that came to the Court, was not clear evidence that Mr. Opeta was totally and permanently disabled. And that's the problem. As I read the record, that's the problem that Judge Ray had with this case.
Yeah, but the problem was that your plan, the contractual terms of your plan, said the decision would be made by Dr. Gold. Now, if you had thought it was appropriate for Dr. Gold to take into consideration the summary of the videotape or the videotapes themselves, shouldn't you have given them to Dr. Gold before he rendered his opinion so that he could make a decision on everything that you consider was in the record?
Presumably, Your Honor, but for the fact that the Northwest Airline or the plan did not have the videotape until shortly before trial.
Videotape, but you had knowledge of it and you had a summary of it right after September 2nd, 2004, and Dr. Gold's medical examination wasn't until November 2004, so there's no reason that you could not have provided that to Dr. Gold so that he could form the basis of his opinion. And had he seen that and been able to form an opinion incorporating that knowledge, he may not have issued the opinion that you later asked him to clarify, which he clarified to be that Mr. Opeta was totally and permanently disabled. You might have, if you had given him the evidence that you thought he should be making his decision on in a timely way, his determination that you were bound to may have very well been different.
I don't disagree with you, because obviously when he saw the videotape, he was shocked.
But you have that, now that was something that you you surprised him with. Now, why would you surprise your own independent and final decision maker with evidence at trial?
I don't think it was a surprise, Your Honor. It was there was an agreement in the record that the videotape would not be shown to Dr. Gold before he testified, and that's what the court found was appropriate.
That was an agreement between you and the other insurer. That was if that was part of what you were compiling as your administrative record as the plan administrator to make a decision on, then it should have been provided to the final determiner before you had to go to trial to dispute this issue.
Let me back up. You'll recall that when the plan comes to trial, the argument is we want an abuse of discretion standard, and we want the administrative record to be considered so that you would have sort of a motion for summary judgment type argument on it. And the reason for that was, if you look at the totality of the reports issued by Dr. Gold, you can't just conclude, as Mr. Opeda's counsel concludes, that Dr. Gold said, yes, he's permanently and totally and permanently disabled.
But that's not the standard of review in this case. And you, by your plain agreement with Mr. Gold, said that you would agree on a doctor who would be the final decision maker, not that you had discretion as the plan administrator to make the decision based on anything you wanted to include. That's not the terms of the agreement.
Right, and which is why it became a de novo review.
Right. Okay, so now we go to a de novo review, and admittedly these administrative insurance claims are a little odd at trial. You concede the court struggled with that in the Kearney decision.
Sure.
And I think counsel have too, and district courts have, like, what are we supposed to do? But it did, no matter how confusing it might be, a couple principles emerge, and two of which play in here. Certainly the plan documents are controlling, and we have the document here that says the doctor is the final opinion in this matter. And second, under Mangaluza, that the district court's not supposed to take additional evidence generally unless it's, you know, essentially absolutely necessary in order to clarify the record below. And Dr. Gold submitted a letter which says that the person is temporarily totally disabled, he's unable to work in any capacity, and then he goes on and he answers the insurance company's questions. Yes, he's totally disabled, he's permanently disabled. And then at the end says there's a remote possibility, maybe he could come back, maybe remotely. So with that, even if you thought that there might be some ambiguity with respect to Dr. Gold's opinion as to what he was looking at, what is the legal basis for admitting the videotape in the face of this record?
I think the legal basis is this. One, when Mr. Opeda argues for de novo review and that's accepted by the court, and Mr. Opeda argues for extrinsic evidence to come in and that's accepted by the court, including Dr. Gold, his client, that opens the door for the defendant to cross-examine those witnesses on their statements, because this is, in effect, new evidence coming in. It's expanding on the administrative record, and that's what happens when there's a de novo review and extrinsic evidence.
But shouldn't the judge look at each piece of evidence separately and say, is this piece of evidence necessary to the decision, not just, oh, I'm going to let and by the way, there was one thing missing in Judge McEwen's chronology. You did, in fact, say, oh, this is ambiguous, but we're going to ask the doctor to clarify. And in his clarification, he said that Mr. Opeda was totally and permanently disabled in the clarification with this remote possibility. To me, that would be the decision. Well, does this remote possibility undercut the permanent? Right. Mm-hmm.
Temporary or permanent.
That would be the legal issue, I would think, that would have been before Judge Ray. But he has to separately then look at these videotapes, which had not formed the basis of Dr. Gold's opinion, which undercuts your agreement that that would be the decision maker.
Let me back up also. Recall the other issue that came up and that we presented to the court was, if, Judge, this is a de novo review, if you think it's we don't have discretionary authority, Judge, please remand it to the plan administrator so that we can supplement, expand the record, and let Dr. Gold see everything. That suggestion was opposed by Mr. Opeda. He said, no, don't remand. Bring in Dr. Gold and have him testify and clarify and explain what he means by what you, Judge Ray, think it may be ambiguous. And at that point now, the judge decides, okay, we're not going to remand. We're going to, at the Mr. Opeda's suggestion, bring in this person to this doctor to discuss his reports. So we're in a position where we've opened this up, and the questions are, I think, if you look at the Quisenberry and the Mongaluza cases, whether Judge Ray abused his discretion by considering evidence that would allow him to make a full, exercise of his judgment in the case, and making considering whether it's necessary to an adequate review of the decision made.
That misconstrues the notion of de novo review. I mean, that's really the standard the judge is using. De novo doesn't mean de new trial. And because Mongaluza says quite clearly, we emphasize the district court should not take additional evidence merely because someone at a later time comes up with new evidence that was not presented to the plan administrator. And here, I can't think of a clearer case where you have a whole new piece of evidence that wasn't part of the administrative record. It just seems that this is exactly what Mongaluza was warning against. Otherwise, you basically are going to turn the district court into a true new trial every time.
But, of course, Mongaluza lets in new evidence that wasn't presented to the plan administrator. And so I think what Mongaluza is doing, and in my interpretation, is that there's a general rule that you want to limit rather than expand these kind of cases.
Here, you had the summary of the tapes. You had access to the tapes. You were the plan administrator. And you clearly had agreed that someone else would make the decision, and you deprived the decision maker of knowledge of those things. To me, it seems as though this was just a trial tactic, and that it ended up being unfair surprise on the person who was entrusted to be the final decision maker, and probably is what Mongaluza wanted to discourage in the first place.
I don't know. I don't believe it was a trial tactic. I believe they didn't have a tape and they didn't provide it, and I'm not sure.
When was it disclosed to counsel for Opeda that you had the tape?
Shortly before, and I wasn't
counsel, understand
but,
that.
But lucky based on you. The record, it was shortly before the date that it was produced, which was in June of 2004, prior to, I think the trial date was scheduled for mid-July.
Right.
So it was about roughly a month. And then, in fact, it's not put on for another 2 months until August of 2004 at that time. And one thing I would also note, and this goes to counsel's position that they fought tooth and nail against admission of this videotape, is if you look at day one lays the foundation for this whole trial. It lays the foundation for Opeda and Dr. Gold coming in, and also Mr. Acklin, counsel for the plan, asked the court, well, can we show the videotape? Now we're going to open this up and have evidence. Can we cross-examine and use the videotape? And the court said yes. And at the time, there is no objection by Mr. Cantor, his counsel then for Mr. Opeda, to this request. And the court says it can come in.
Well, but the record is pretty well pasted with objections to the videotape.
Subsequently, I suppose, because it was bad.
No, there's some before, in the trial brief. And, it seemed to me once they found out about the videotape, I'd be hard-pressed to figure out in the record where they said, come on in to the videotape. That, I think, would be an unfair characterization of the record. A little unclear, maybe, on Dr. Gold, but it didn't seem like, I don't think you can argue waiver on the videotape.
Certainly 2 months later, they realized that this was not a good development, that Dr. Gold could be, you know, cross-examined.
Let me question you a little bit about that. How is this proper cross-examination of Dr. Gold if, in fact, he hadn't ever seen the videotape? And so your cross-examination is supposed to, I guess, cast doubt on his opinion and or impeach him with something like a prior inconsistent statement or say he had seen the videotape and still rendered a total and permanent disabled. I don't even see how this is legitimate impeachment of Dr. Gold because he never saw it before.
I don't believe, and I think I agree, I'm not sure it was really impeachment because he didn't see it and then presented with it, change his mind or say something differently. But what I think it is the presentation. Let me think of a way to characterize this.
Well, you brought it out on cross-examination of Dr. Gold, right?
Correct.
I'm saying it's not proper there. So then maybe what you're reaching for is the question of whether you had an independent right to introduce it.
Right, and because he's clarifying his opinion and expanding on his opinion on direct, whether then we can ask him to expand further and take into consideration.
How can he properly take into consideration a videotape made in September of 2002 before Mr. Gold's, you know, the very immediate flare-up that occurred at the end of October where he was hospitalized for 5 days, and then he sees Dr. Gold and Gold renders his opinion. How can that possibly bear on his opinion?
Well, you're asking me to say what the record said, which is it did bear on his opinion without having seen it before. And, of course, that evidence was put into the record. I mean, there was that evidence that, oh, you know, I did this and then I had the flare-up and it was all as a result of essentially doing this one-time gardening effort.
It seems to me the confusion is what opinion. You entered into your company entered into a contract that they would be bound by Dr. Gold's opinion, not his opinion at court, but the opinion he would make. Now, the video has nothing to do with the opinion he made. It may have something to do with changing his mind. But if you've entered into a contract that it'll only be determined by what he said before, then I can see clarification of ambiguity, if there is any. It looks pretty straightforward. But it wouldn't be bringing in new evidence that he's better or worse. It would have to be clarifying a prior opinion, not the current opinion. So I'm having difficulty with the relevance of anything that happened after his opinion was made. Maybe you could clarify.
Well, you know, the best I can do with that, Your Honor, is to say this. Once there's this de novo review and the extrinsic evidence comes in, the court has said, I want to make an informed judgment about whether what's going on here. I don't believe the reports are clear and unambiguous. I think there's room for interpretation. Let's find out what Dr. Gold's opinion really is. Let's find out if he thinks this person is totally and permanently disabled. And what happens is,
that's where he may have gotten off because it's not what he is today. He may have been following the complaint and that he has to make a decision. And if I read the complaint and there was no pretrial, I might come to the same conclusion. I need to find out what his current condition is today. And I'd say, sure, bring in the evidence that'll help Dr. Gold make an appropriate decision. But I'm not sure if the pleadings don't govern and you just have the plan, which talks about a prior opinion, I'm not sure changing his opinion by subsequent facts is relevant to what you contracted would happen. That's where I'm having a problem.
What I think is it's relevant once the court opens this up on a de novo review and permitting extrinsic evidence.
Can a court open it up and change the contract?
No.
No.
No, but if you look at what happened here is the court takes in all the evidence. It takes in Dr. Gold's opinion, including his opinion that, oh, I've been tricked here, a total and permanent disabled person cannot garden for 2.5 hours and do whatever he was doing. if you take, I think if you take that into account, what's happened really is what we were trying to get in the first place, which was a remand to expand the administrative record, if it's a de novo review, to allow the plan administrator to revisit the ambiguities and reopen the record. But it happens at the district court level because the judge has determined, I need to make a full and independent judgment here. I think it's necessary for an adequate review of whether the decision below was appropriate. I think it's necessary in order to do my duty with respect to what has been asked for in the complaint. And so what happens is you have essentially a small trial that opens up this issue again of whether he's totally disabled. And he's able, on the one hand, to expand on his reports and say, oh, when I really said he might get back to work, I'm essentially saying he's total and permanent. That doesn't really count, which you can't tell from the three reports, I don't think, put together. But also he's presented with evidence that at that point that contradicts the claim by Mr. Opeta that he's totally
permanently
disabled.
Well, not really, because at the conclusion of his direct examination, it seems there's no ambiguity about his opinion.
I would agree that is favorable to him, although he does come back separate and apart from the videotape and say, well, look, because of the position I was in and because of this flare-up, I really couldn't make a determination of whether he would be permanently disabled or disabled long-term. He says that when he's cross-examined. Then he goes on to the videotape after that and
but
says,
really,
this is inconsistent.
Kind of, I think maybe that confusion really is in the district court, maybe confusing de novo review with kind of a whole trial on the topic. I mean, I don't think the district court, if the question was, well, what did you mean by a remote possibility, or what did you mean by possibly there could be some hard-to-imagine sedentary job that he might do, what do you mean by that? Because then you have to fall into what does total permanent disability mean under the plan, which is not necessarily the same as we think of it, you know, in terms of common parlance. So it just seemed to me at the end of his direct examination, there was nothing more to be had, actually. It was quite clear if there was any ambiguity before. So I'm just thinking that at that point, you'd have to have some justification for needing the video, wouldn't you?
Well, let me make 2 points here. One is just to get back to a point that I skipped over. What Judge Ray really does here in the end is he honors the contract, but in the context of the trial. In other words, what Dr. Gold's ultimate opinion is he's not totally and permanently disabled. That's what comes out of the cross. And what Judge Ray does is say, well, he's the last word, and he said now once we've opened this up and presented extrinsic evidence, that he's not totally and permanently disabled. All I can say in terms of Judge Ray's ability to do what he did is, once he decides de novo review, then does he abuse his discretion by wanting to have informed, I think it's Quisenberry, enable a full exercise informed and independent judgment about what the truth is here.
So that's what we're going to end up deciding, and I think your time has expired unless there's...
One minute, but that's all right.
That's the issue.
All right,
yeah.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Your Honors, I'd like to make three very brief points. Dr. Gold's determination was never ambiguous, as I think was pointed out in the questions. He was asked a precise question of total and permanent disability, and his response was, yes, Mr. Opeta is totally and permanently disabled. I submit to the court that the language of a remote possibility with further treatment that he could return to work, you know, it isn't legally relevant language. I mean, you know, there's a remote possibility that almost anything can take place. There's a remote possibility that I could burst into flame in the next 10 seconds, but, you know, that's not...
I hope not.
I hope not too, Your Honor. The that's number one. Number two, the defendant did know about the videotape when it submitted the matter to Dr. Gold, and it knew about the videotape when it decided the case. It obviously didn't think the videotape was necessary at the time, because if it believed it was necessary at the time, it would have taken some steps to obtain it. And so it seems that in later on, going in front of the district court and saying, well, it's necessary now, it's the same videotape, it's the same facts.
Saying necessary to Dr. Gold's final determination.
If the
plan thought it was necessary to Dr. Gold's final determination, they should have given it to him when he was making that determination.
That's exactly right, Your Honor, and it's clearly an ad hoc determination. They don't really think it's necessary. What they really mean is we didn't like Dr. Gold's first result, and so now we need to kind of give him some more evidence and hope we get a better result this time. Which is clearly not the intent of the contract, and is fundamentally unfair. On top of that, Your Honor. Finally, with respect to Judge Wallace's comments about the complaint, I admit they're well taken. There's a technical reason why in the complaint you ask for a finding of disability, and I've been in this situation from a practical point of view before. As a matter of fact, I'm sort of in it right now in a case that I have pending where you know. What you're really asking for is the judge to overturn the determination of the plan fiduciary. But if you get an order that just says that, then the question is, well, now what happens?
But here, what you are trying to do is get the district court to enforce the contract of Dr. Gold's opinion. That's a fairly simple pleading.
It is, Your Honor. Although at the end of the day, if there's not a finding that Mr. Opeta is entitled to benefits, worded in some way, shape, or form, and I'll admit it could have been done more artfully, then Mr. Opeta doesn't get paid, which is the point to what we're doing here today.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
We have your points in mind, and
thank you, Your Honor.
The case is submitted. I thank both counsel for your arguments.